Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Glad you're with me today. In about a half an hour of conversation with Kinsey Wilson, Executive Vice President and Chief Content Officer for National Public Radio. And this role is responsible for establishing a unified vision for NPR's journalism and working with member stations to build an effective partnership for the future. And our conversation is about the future of radio. How will we be consuming radio services from providers such as NPR in the future? Specifically, we'll talk about a new partnership between NPR and Ford Motor Company. It's called the Connected Car, and it's a voice-activated radio system. That's coming up. In this half of the program, one of the preeminent historians in America, Richard Bushman, who was on the USU campus last week for the Religious Studies program at USU, giving a lecture titled The Many Lives of Joseph Smith's Gold Plates. Joseph Smith claimed to have the gold plates of the Book of Mormon in his possession less than 21 months, yet the plates have lived on in the imagination of believers and unbelievers alike. They were a central feature in the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Angels in America, as well as the subject of a Primer children's song. Also, of course, the musical on Broadway that's a big hit, the Book of Mormon, the musical. What gives these plates their longevity and vitality in so many venues? That was the lecture. Richard Bushman, his books include From Puritan to Yankee, Character and the Social Order of Connecticut, A Great Awakening, Documents on the Revival of Religion, and King and People in Provincial Massachusetts. And, of course, his groundbreaking Rough Stone Rolling is the most influential biography of Mormonism's founder, Joseph Smith. We talked about the ongoing Mormon moment, also acceptance of new religions, religion in America, and the divide between religion and science. Here's my conversation with Richard Bushman from last week. Your presentation here at to USU, The Many Lives of Joseph Smith's Gold Plates, we can tick off the bullet points of, of how this has seeped into popular culture, starting with the Broadway musical, and of course Angels in America a few years back. Seems like this is part of this continuing Mormon moment. And I wonder what facets of that you're specifically, at least in this lecture, looking at the golden plates. Mm-hmm. So what parts of that do you draw out?
Well, the golden plates, have disappeared. No one sees them. No one knows what they really looked like or felt like, but they live on in the imagination. And these story of them is that people use them for their own purposes in many, many different ways. So in Angels in America, they're a symbol of Pryor's rejection of heaven's bid to turn him into a prophet. He says, I want nothing to do with God who would treat this world the way he does. So he returns the plates, sort of the reversal of Joseph Smith accepting them and translating them. And everybody who picks them up for one purpose or another, uses them in their own way, beginning with the early critics, Joseph Smith and his friends, everybody down the line. There are scores of stories that have been told that people are making the most of the plates to make some point of their own.
Mm. And that's the key, I guess, isn't it? To make some point of their own. It becomes whatever they want to make of it.
Yeah. In my lecture on the gold plates, I'm talking about how the early critics, people in the Palmyra village who were very critical of the Smith family, were not just rejecting Joseph Smith, but they were rejecting a whole world of superstition that the Enlightenment should have squelched. And they're embarrassed that an enlightened nation could produce things that harken back to the Middle Ages, ghosts, goblins, witches, and so on. And this represented that superstition that should be, in the course of human progress, should be utterly eliminated. So their vehemence is not because of anything Joseph Smith did or his family did, but what they represented to these enlightened people.
This would have especially been in opposition to the Enlightenment. You can understand that. But bringing it forward, you do hear criticism of the origin beliefs, stories from not only Mormonism, but other religions in today's, I guess, very scientifically focused culture.
Well, there is this fissure. It never is adequately bridged between revelatory religions, in which I'd include Islam, Christianity, Judaism, and Mormonism, and the scientific insistence that if it cannot be sensed, then it's nonsense and has no reality. But the fact of the matter is that all of these great religions are initiated by a revelatory moment in which the believers see the hand of God intervening in human affairs, and that gives the momentum to that religion that will last for centuries, in the case of the resurrection, for example. But the event itself never gets beyond controversy. It's always a subject of debate and contention.
Always will be, do you think?
I don't see how it can be avoided.
Do you see that fissure widening?
Well, it certainly has in recent years with this aggressive form of atheism. It used to be the sensible position was agnosticism. Well, we can't really know, but you have your beliefs, but I can't accept them. Now there is this sense that religion is a positive evil in the world, and so must be scourged in a way. It has to be stamped out if humanity is to make any progress. So it's in some ways the world is getting more aggressively secular, at least from the viewpoint of religious people.
More aggressively secular, do you think there are religions that would fit in the middle of that fissure or be more acceptable to people on the other side?
Well, yes, there are always degrees of tension with sort of the ambient culture. And Mormonism would have a high degree of tension because of these extravagant claims of revelation in various forms. The Episcopal religion, with its belief in the divine origins of Christianity, would be less, especially since the word resurrection, which is the key miracle in this, of course, can be used in so many different ways. You don't know if it really means a dead body came back to life, or does it mean the divine spirit came back into the lives of believers. So it's become much easier to be a certain kind of liberal Christian than to be a Mormon.
Now, even in the face of this more militant atheism and a widening fissure, there is growth, sometimes very fast growth, among some of these, what you might call the religions on the far side of the spectrum, some of these revelatory religions.
Yeah. Well, that's... that has been a significant fact interrupting what was the standard view of religion on the part of sociologists, for example. There was this view that secularism was creeping. It was like creeping socialism. It would eventually take over the whole world as science just eliminated one base after another of Christian belief. But somewhere in the 70s, sociologists began to see it's not happening. Maybe certain forms of religion were withering, but there were other forms of religion popping up all over the place. And, of course, they're thinking of Pentecostals, which is, you know, fabulous growth pattern across the globe. But also new religions of all sorts of varieties. So that now I think... at least certain group of very important sociologists see that the religious impulse is irrepressible. It will just keep coming back. It's like hunger or sex. Some people just have to have it. So it isn't a question of it disappearing. It's a question of what form will it take to be most vital. And evangelicalism is certainly one of those.
But the point of view of the atheists, others on that side of the fissure, they see it as something that needs to be stamped out, as you were saying before.
Yeah, there is this sense that unbalanced religion has been an evil influence. And that is an old line of Enlightenment thought. The Enlightenment really grows out of the 30 Years' War of the 17th century, where the religion, where the Protestant and Catholic forces were posed against one another. And for 30 years, just exhausted Europe, exhausted its population, fighting what can be read as over a fundamental religious issue. And in the late 17th century, late 1600s, there grew up a band of intellectuals who were finding some way to rise above religious disputes. And science takes its roots at that moment. And science seemed to be a way of settling disputes without having to refer to doctrine or some kind of controverted base. And so that, of course, remains the hope of these people, is that they can eliminate those contentious issues.
So, the atheists will point out the, and there's, admittedly, from the religious point of view, many bullet points you can point to, evils perpetuated in the name of religion. Is it just a case of religion? If you can, you know, it's not a monolith, but if you look at it that way, it's a case of bad PR. is there a pushback that the religious side of that fissure should point out the good?
Well, you ask. Can you say religion is really responsible for the great evils of the world? I mean, look at the Civil War. The worst war in our history by far, a huge number of deaths. That's a war for democracy, really. Equality is what drives that. There's a religious dimension, but it isn't religion that drives that war. And some people say that fascism is a kind of religion. So what happens is people who say it's religion's fault label anything they don't like, like communism or fascism, as a form of religion. And if you eliminate those, well, then if you say those are religion, then, of course, there's lots of evil in the world. But I think it's hard to say that religion, as it's understood by most people who go to a Catholic church every Sunday, is really responsible for the great evils of the 20th century. You just can't say that.
I suppose you could put the advance of science, the investigation of science, the interest of science in faith, belief. Where does that come from? Trying to explain it scientifically, you could put that in the context of what we've been talking about. And I wonder what you make of those attempts by science to understand this.
To see science within as part of a religious view of the world?
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, for at least a century, the liberal wing of Protestantism and to a certain extent Catholicism has felt that there really is not a basic incompatibility, that evolution, which was the great blow at the foundations of religious belief, can be absorbed into a religious view of the world. And that's happened everywhere. I mean, there are Mormons who believe in evolution to a large extent and don't feel like it's incompatible. And most other of those sort of concrete descriptions of the universe that seem to conflict with the Bible, say, have been reconciled. I think what remains as the contested arena is in the realm of epistemology. What can you know? And if you resort to something that's called scientism, which is that only the things that a scientist can know are true and can be lived by, then, of course, you eliminate all sorts of religion. But there's some very good scientists who argue that there are realms of human knowledge and human experience, and you can't just obliterate every realm but science. They're just too valuable to human life.
You talk about this liberal wing of religion. At the same time, at least in the political realm, there heats up and wanes, this culture battle. Science on one hand, religion on the other. Seems to have heated up with the campaign of Rick Santorum lately. I suppose that'll always be with us?
I think it always will be with us. It's been the the American goal to keep religion within strict bounds, both to protect it and to protect the state from undue religious influence. But the fact of the matter is, people who are deeply religious cannot help but bring religious perspectives to bear on their political viewpoints. And it's a form of censorship to say, no, don't think a religious thought about your candidate for the president. It will never happen so long as people have any religion at all. Mm. So I see no end to that conflict. It will just simply take new forms. Mm.
Where are we, do you think? I mean, you've studied early America and religion, and it has a unique place, doesn't it, in American history. But I wonder, are there changes in that uniquely religious strain in American life? Essential changes, do you think, mm-hmm. now, you know, in the last few decades?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think it's as different as you might think would occur over a course of 200 years. In some ways, the early founding fathers were more tolerant of religion having a place in the state than we are today. I mean, they have prayers to open Congress, and even Thomas Jefferson, who believed more as strongly as anyone there has to be a separation, tolerated that. They declared fast days in which the nation was to pray to God for its blessing. What they didn't want is some religious denomination trying to foist its views upon the state as a form of favoritism for itself, or because there had been endless controversies through the 18th century in that kind of way. And then on the other side, you get Roger Williams, who's most concerned that the state is going to muck up religion, and the state is a secular institution, and so it just should have nothing to do with religion. So it's an old issue that takes many new forms, but I don't think that the basic question is much different now than then.
Hmm. It seems like the tension was there at the beginning, people escaping religious persecution. Mm-hmm. But many of those same people wanting to impose their views on anyone in that colony.
Yeah. Well, Massachusetts, of course, is what you're thinking of. And they believed in freedom of religion, by which they meant freedom to practice their religion. Mm. It wasn't freedom to anyone else. And in those days, even Williams admitted that the religion of the state was of a huge import. That is, if you had someone who did not believe in God, how could you trust them with the power of the state? And if you believed in the wrong kind of God, if you're a Catholic, for example, and had allegiance to the Pope, that could be disastrous for the state. So it was an issue that had some basis in the realities of that time. But though from our point of view, it seems, they're unduly harsh to Quakers and Baptists and others.
I want to come back around to this. I mean, we keep calling it the Mormon moment. It seems to keep continuing, especially I think it's probably as long as Mitt Romney is running for president. Mm-hmm. And we had Book of Mormon, the musical. I don't know if you saw it. What do you thought of that?
The tickets are just too costly. Mm-hmm. We live in New York and we're going to have to see it sometime. But I've got endless reports on it, so I can speak authoritatively, having never seen it.
Please do speak authoritatively.
Yeah,
having never seen it.
Well, it has had differing effects on differing people. It is so obscene. It's maybe the most obscene play ever to appear on Broadway, and it's just extravagant. Blasphemous comments about God, not about Mormons, about God. So that is offensive to a lot of people. Mormons are razzed. They're certainly made fun of. But in the end, they seem like sweet, good-hearted people who are probably doing more good in the world then they're doing harm. Mm. And so the Mormons who can manage to sit through the whole thing, at the end don't walk out of it feeling like they've been done in. On the other hand, we talked to a Catholic one time who had seen it, and he thought it was slanderous. It was anti-Mormonism in the spirit of anti-Semitism. It really was meant to hurt. Most Mormons I talk to don't feel that way, but I have to allow that there are some people who will walk out of that theater thinking ill of Mormons. I think there are many more who are sort of curious and maybe a little scornful secretly in their hearts about Mormon beliefs, but still sort of a kindly feeling. We are, and my wife and I are teaching a course at Columbia on contemporary Mormonism to non-Mormon kids, a small group, about 20. And they had a very positive view of Mormonism to start with. We sent them all to church and had them write a paper on the subject, and they were invariably upbeat about, you know, what a happy, good people they were, how friendly and warm. Mm. So I think, by and large, there's a pretty positive view of Mormons even after plays like the Book of Mormon.
Mm. Do you think, and there's, I don't know if there's a usual trajectory, new religions, opposition, and then gradual acceptance. I don't know if you see Mormonism fitting in that and where this moment fits.
Oh, it definitely does. I mean, America is a tolerant place. It always has tolerated religions, which means that you can, in your own sphere, worship how you please. But then there's another line, which is acceptance into the realm of political responsibility. Will we let you have the power of state in your hands? And that is a much smaller group. And it takes a while for groups to pass that barrier. It happened in 1960, quite obviously, with John Kennedy and for the Catholics. And now, you know, we have, what, 5 or 6 Supreme Court justices who are Catholics? That would have been impossible in the 1950s, when there was still a lot of antagonism towards Catholicism. Look at all the evangelicals. Who are they voting for? A very conservative Catholic in Rick Santorum. So that is a huge change. Mormonism was right on that border. Some people said yes, some people said no, and it wasn't just evangelicals. There were a lot of liberal, secular politicians and commentators who didn't want a Mormon in because of their beliefs. But you can just sort of feel the gears grinding, and that barrier is being passed. And the big sign of it now is that you can no longer make public fun of the Mormons. You could in 2008. You can't in 2012. You look like a bigot if you do. So John King on CNN really went after Reverend Jeffress of Dallas when he called Mormonism a cult. He went after him, you know, very vigorously. He said, made it clear that this was unacceptable behavior.
Hmm. So you think the Book of Mormon, the musical, if it had been harsher, essentially harsh toward Mormons, maybe wouldn't have flown?
It probably not. People would have become, feel like you can't hurt people that way. It's fun to sort of razz them. One reviewer said this is like getting into a fraternity. You have to go through this hazing period, and if you can take that, then you're inside and you're one of the gang.
Do you see in the next couple of decades Mormonism becoming fully accepted member of that club then?
I think it will be fully accepted by a larger and larger proportion of the population. But, you know, there's still people who don't like Catholics. There will always be pockets, and probably centered in the South, who won't do it. I liken it to the view, to the response to a black president. No one can say, I'm against Barack Obama because he's black. But there are pockets of people we know very well who don't want a black president person in the White House. And I'm sure that will remain true for Mormons for a long time.
Mm-hmm. From the point of view of the, I'm sure Mormons are not the only ones. Any religion which is kind of on that trajectory toward acceptance is going to be nervous about, and I'm sure many Mormons are nervous this moment with so much attention. Point of view of a Mormon, you hope it's good attention. Some of it is, some of it's not. I guess if you're not Mormon, you're curious about it, but you're not as invested. And I wonder where we are on that. You know, it seems to be, as you say, you can't openly make fun now, but not fully accepted.
I think Mormons will be nervous for a long time to come. I mean, if a Mormon is at a dinner party of non-Mormons, say in Iowa somewhere outside of Mormon country, and Mormonism comes up at the dinner table, I can guarantee you most of the Mormons at that table are going to tense up. What is going to be said? Can I defend the church? Can I make a good case for the church? Is this a chance to do a little missionary work? You know, we get all nervous about it. And that will probably continue, but the only way to get over that nervousness is to have it happen over and over again. And in our time, it's happening. It's just in the air, so that Mormons all over the country are having people make inquiries, and gradually it'll just become a part of your life. You know, like talking about your favorite sports team. It's just what I love and what I do.
You were saying before that there are new religions popping up. That's just just a part of what's happening. And I wonder if you see those religions going that on that same trajectory. I guess specifically I'm asking, are there some religions that maybe are a little further out than Mormonism but are on that trajectory that you see maybe will coming up and getting their moment soon?
Well, it's very interesting. I think that Jehovah's Witnesses are still outside. Since they have no interest in public office, they discourage their members from getting involved in politics. Their moment probably will not come. The Seventh-day Adventists are the group that interest me. They're faster growing than Mormons worldwide. They're not quite as much a presence in the United States as they are elsewhere. But they have a very good reputation because of their health code, their terrific hospitals, good sense. So I could see a moment where a Seventh-day Adventist, someone would come along and they would be accepted. The Unification Church, the Moonies, are still outside, and so is Scientology. Scientology is getting very bad press these days, and it would have a terrible time getting crossing that barrier. But it'll be interesting to watch if there's someone will rise up, as Mitt Romney rose up from their ranks, in a way publicizing this group as an applicant for admission to this inner circle.
Does it take a push from the religion itself? Mormonism has been making a push over the last few years for acceptance, it seems like.
Yeah. Well, that's true. We have a very active and I think a very competent public affairs that is really searching for ways to do it. Mormons do it because they're so committed to proselyting. And, you know, there's always that undercurrent of we want to be acceptable so that you might accept us seriously. These other groups are in differing degrees, missionizing churches. The Scientologists are in some ways pretty aggressive. They're the ones who invented I Am a Scientologist campaign. The Mormon I Am a Mormon campaign really follows that the same pattern. So they might possibly make a push, but they're going to have a tough time.
Just a couple more questions. I'm interested in this these new religions popping up. I don't know if you have any examples you could cite us. And specifically, I'm wondering, Mormonism, I believe Seventh-day Adventism, both American-born religions.
So is Jehovah's Witnesses.
Jehovah's Witnesses. Are there certain nations which have climates which are good incubators for religions?
Well, the I guess America leads the ranks. I can't really speak too well for China or Japan. I think every country is going to have some form of it. But the fact that we have sort of an open culture in so many different ways that we're all familiar with means that this is the breeding ground in a place like California, where, you know, you have a mix of people who in old institutions, old institution dominates the state there, unlike the Baptists, say, in the South, or the Congregationalists and Universalists in New England. So, yeah, I think we're as good as any at producing new religions.
Mm. Finally, just to wonder what you're up to. You mentioned you and your wife teaching class at Columbia. You've retired from Claremont.
Yes, we had a visiting professorship there. Mm-hmm. I was the Howard W. Hunter chair. Claudia taught religion from a woman's perspective, Latter-day Saint religion. That was a three-year appointment. There's now a new person appointed in my place, a man named Patrick Mason, terrific young scholar. We're back in New York and just offered to the religion department at Columbia to teach a course on contemporary Mormonism. They were very interested. It filled up the first day of registration. Students are very, very interested. Mm. So we're having a lot of fun with that.
Mm. So another book on the horizon. I know, you know, Rough Stone Rolling, that's a big book. It's gotten good press, mm-hmm. but I don't know if you rest a little while after you do a biography of Joseph Smith.
Well, I have another line of scholarship in early American history. And I'm working on a book on 18th century farming in America, which I've been working on for many years. But my other big project is a cultural history of the gold plates.
Hmm. Very good. We'll look for that. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Professor Richard Bushman, one of the preeminent historians in America, was on the Utah State University campus last week as a guest of the Religious Studies program at USU, giving a lecture titled The Many Lives of Joseph Smith's Gold Plates. Professor Bushman, books include From Puritan to Yankee, Great Awakening, King and People in Provincial Massachusetts, The Refinement of America, and he wrote a path-breaking biography of Mormonism's founder Joseph Smith called Rough Stone Rolling. Professor Bushman taught at Harvard, Boston University, BYU, and University of Delaware before becoming the Gouverneur Morris Professor of History at Columbia University, where he taught for many years, and as you heard, until last year, was Howard W. Hunter Visiting Professor of Mormon History at Claremont Graduate University. Our thanks to the Religious Studies Program at USU and to Professor Bushman for that interview. Coming up following Steve Eaton commentary, we'll look at the future of radio. It's a new app that NPR has collaborated with Ford on, which delivers in-car, on-demand access to programs. I'll talk with Kinsey Wilson, Executive Vice President, Chief Content Officer for NPR, coming up.
Steve Eaton is a freelance writer who lives in Logan. He writes a column that appears in the Deseret News every other Saturday.
I need some sleep. I don't complain about it, however, because I know what will happen if I do. You will tell me that you have it worse than I do. If I've only gotten 5 hours sleep, you'll tell me that you got only 3 hours of sleep. If I say I got three, you'll tell me you haven't slept in weeks. This is an incredible phenomenon that plays out everywhere. As soon as this commentary is over, I have an experiment for you. Try complaining to someone else nearby you that you're tired and need some sleep. It's a sure thing that you'll get no sympathy. You can even try this at home, even if you live alone. Complain that you're tired out loud. You can be sure that someone will appear from nowhere to top your story. Might be just your dog or your goldfish, but someone or something will tell you that they are more tired than you ever could be. We've become a country that likes to brag about how little sleep we get. We do this because we have decided that those people who are very, very busy are also very important. We've added the corollary that really important people either don't have time to sleep or they can't sleep. They can't sleep because they are too busy and important to sleep. I feel sorry for my two children. They too are very, very tired all the time. It must be even more troubling for them than it is for me. I know the reason I'm tired is because I don't go to bed on time. They see absolutely no relationship between when they go to bed and how they feel in the morning. They feel that life is just randomly cruel to them, especially in the mornings. Not sleeping does damage to our bodies and our state of mind. However, We don't brag about causing ourselves physical pain in other ways. Imagine if you heard a water cooler conversation like this. Jeannie, I've been out hitting myself on the head with this broom handle all morning and I feel awful. Charles, you're lucky you're just beating yourself about the head with a broom handle. I've been using this tire jack. George, a tire jack would be like heaven to me. I've been using this sledgehammer over and over again since 6 a.m. Jeannie, you use a sledgehammer? Really? You're way important. We as a society do not think others more important just because they've mastered the art of self-inflicted head injuries. Why should sleep deprivation be different? Something must be done. I would propose a national nap initiative. Companies would be required by law to provide little rugs to their workers and 20 minutes of quiet time at about 2 p.m. each afternoon. We'd have to think of a way, however, to involve the people who are earnestly being busy. They would immediately argue that they are too important, that they don't have time to nap. Is there a way to make people completely ignore everyone around them and just go into some sort of workplace coma? At first I thought not, but then I remembered an amazing experience I had at a downtown Seattle post office. That day I noticed that the two people who were serving the long line appeared to actually be asleep while they worked. It was as if they were doing everything in slow motion. Their supervisor was obviously proud of them because he decided to count stamps at a closed station so that he could watch them drift in and out of consciousness as the line grew. He moved a little faster than they did, but seemed strangely unaware of his customers. So it can be done. We must tell the executives and other important people in our lives to go to bed. It's not often that a call to arms is also a directive to go to bed. This is one time you can take a stand by lying down. This is one revolution worth sleeping through. This is Steve Eaton.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from USU Dining Services, proud sponsor and facilitator of the Chef Cook-Off and fundraiser Spice on Ice this Thursday, featuring USU's own Corey Cousins and chefs from around Cache Valley. Online at dining.usu.edu.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll spend the hour with Ambassador Peter Thompson, author of The Wars of Afghanistan, Messianic Terrorism, Tribal Conflicts, and the Failures of Great Powers. Peter Thompson was President George H.W. Bush's ambassador to the Mujahideen and is an expert on Afghanistan. He's in Logan today and tomorrow as a guest of the USU Political Science Department, and we'll talk about Afghanistan for the hour tomorrow. Now, a conversation from a few months ago with Kinsey Wilson, Executive Vice President and Chief Content Officer for NPR. He's recently received that promotion, and so when I talked to him, he had a different title, but on the digital side for NPR. Recent survey has shown that drivers are increasingly taking advantage of wireless connections to stream audio on the road. NPR is getting involved with Ford to provide a new app which lets Ford drivers listen to their favorite public radio programs on the go. It's voice activated. We wanted to talk about this connected car program with Kinsey Wilson. So the connected cars is what this called. This is a partnership with Ford, I understand it. Are there other companies involved?
At the moment, the sole partnership that we have is with Ford. We have been working in this space for about 18 months and have relationships in various stages of development with about a dozen different car manufacturers and their equipment manufacturers, and fully expect to be introducing our app into other connected car environments with other automakers in the coming months and years.
So at this point, I guess you have to have a Ford.
And then
how does this work?
So the simplest way to think about it is if you are running the NPR app on your Android or iPhone device, the way you would use it normally, if you get into the car, essentially the car detects that you have an app that is designed to work with the system in that car, and it translates the controls away from the phone itself and puts them on the steering wheel and activates the voice commands and makes the dashboard radio control the piece that controls the entire app. So what it allows you to do is put your hands on the wheel and keep your eyes on the road and control the app without looking down at your phone and risking distracted driving.
So this is voice activated?
It's voice activated, but you can also control it in the way that you do a conventional radio, and then there are small tabs on the steering wheel itself that also allow you to control it that way.
Is this only with Android?
Android and Apple.
And Apple as well. Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And there are plans? You're working on expanding this beyond Ford cars?
Yeah, one of the things we're seeing as we've been talking to the car companies is that all of them are, in one way or another, planning to introduce this technology across most of their product lines in the next couple of years. This is not something that they're simply building in as an option or as a luxury item or as an extra cost item. They see it very much as something that consumers are demanding. Consumers are already bringing their smartphones into their cars, and many of them are finding ways to connect them to the existing systems over Bluetooth or over, a simple wire jack, and are expecting some kind of fuller integration. And so they see this as a way to enhance their vehicles and to sell more cars. And because they're not trying to sell a separate service, say the way satellite radio did, because they're riding on the data plan that you already have on your smartphone, our expectation is the consumer adoption of this will take off much more rapidly than it did with some earlier technologies, that this won't simply be a niche play.
And in fact, generally, I'm reading here some materials sent to me from NPR. Time spent listening to online radios increased 49% the last 3 years.
Yeah, I think we're approaching a point where, online listening to radio has been gradually increasing over time since 1995. I think the first online stream was a baseball game in 1995. And there's been a sort of very steady, slow, incremental increase in people listening over the Internet. I think we're going to see that really start to take off. And the reason simply is that wireless broadband connections are more ubiquitous and more reliable every day. Radio is relatively compact compared to video and streams reasonably well over those systems. And we're seeing suddenly now in the last couple of years just an explosion of different devices, from tablets to smartphones to connected refrigerators to God knows what else. Essentially, every device is becoming an Internet-connected device, and many of them are ideally suited to radio. So suddenly radio is everywhere, and I think we're going to see, I don't think this in any way spells the demise or the decline of traditional over-the-air broadcast, but it opens up new avenues for listening that haven't been there before.
I was going to ask you about that. Where will we be listening mostly, say, 20 or 30 years from now? Will we be mothballing our regular radios, and this will all be on our smartphones?
I think some of that will be driven by how quickly consumer adoption takes place around these new devices. Some of it will be driven by the economics. And the economics are very much in flux. There's a certain hard cost to maintaining radio towers and the infrastructure that traditionally has surrounded all of that. But there's also a consumer cost attached to constantly accessing your data plan. And over time, we'll understand better sort of how those net out and whether they favor one particular form of listening over another. I think, undoubtedly, if technology trends continue directionally the way they have over the last 10, 15, 20 years, the costs on the new technology side will steadily come down, and consumers will gradually embrace these devices, in part because they offer greater control, greater choice, greater portability. But I think radio, unlike perhaps some other media, newspapers in particular, is not necessarily going to see a rapid transition. But rather, I think we're just going to see a new landscape opening up in the short term that may well give us an opportunity to expand the programming choices that listeners have at their disposal.
I'm guessing you've done research on this. Changing platforms, has that changed the way listeners generally are listening? I'm thinking of, you know, you just pull up your favorite show, get that in a podcast later on, playlist of just your topic you want to listen to. Do you think that will be the way of the future?
You know, it's really interesting. The research we did in advance of launching with Ford showed us a couple of things. On the one hand, our listeners' devotion to their connection to their local station remains very, very strong. Even with these new technologies and the added choice that it gives them, they rank at the top of the list of their preferences listening to their local station. At the same time, they also are eager to be able to tune in at the time of their choice, as opposed if they happen to miss something at the appointed time when it was broadcast on air, to be able to TiVo something in effect, to record it and listen later, to be able to rewind certain things, to be able to walk in the house instead of sitting in their driveway during those driveway moments when they want to listen to the end of a particular story. So I think they both are embracing the added features and benefits that come with this technology, but they also feel a very strong attachment and loyalty to what they've traditionally known on radio.
Just a minute left. Remind us, this is this latest product. If you have Android or Apple smartphone, you have the right app, and you're in your Ford car, you can have the connected car and listen to NPR programming.
That's right.
So what specifically do you need? You need the what's called the Sync app link?
Yeah, this works specifically with Ford vehicles that are equipped with the Ford Sync system, which is an in-dash system that they've deployed over the last 3 years or so. And then on top of that, what they call their app link system, which is what allows the car to detect that you've got an app, a compatible app, on your smartphone. And they're both continuing to roll this out pretty aggressively across a variety of product lines and also updating and putting new software in cars that are already out there.
And we'll be seeing more to come.
Yes, across many different automakers.
Very good. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Glad to do it.
Okay, thanks. Bye. A glimpse into where radio's going. More people are wanting to hear their favorite programs on the road through their smartphone. You can now do that in Ford cars with the NPR programs, and that probably, as you heard, will be expanded. I was talking there with Kinsey Wilson, who is now NPR's Executive Vice President and Chief Content Officer. A few months ago when I'd record this interview, he had a different title. He's recently been promoted. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we certainly hope that you'll be with us as we talk about Afghanistan. Unfortunately, it's been in the news with the recent shootings. We are all wondering what the end game might be in Afghanistan, the future of the country. And we have with us tomorrow a Afghanistan expert, former ambassador to the Mujahideen, and author of The Wars of Afghanistan, Messianic Terrorism, Tribal Conflicts, and the Failures of Great Powers. Peter Thompson is his name. He's on campus of Utah State University today and tomorrow as a guest of the USU Political Science Department. That's the program tomorrow. Thanks for listening today.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.